to a spooky Halloween art soul.
Yes, it's our favourite time of year.
Yes, and I feel like the dead.
Well, there you go. Getting on board.
We should introduce ourselves. My name is B. Roberts. I'm a scriptwriter and a script doctor. With me I have author, bon vivant, man who just offered me a donut.
Yeah, I did get you a donut. Yes, yeah, you should do that in that ascending order of importance, really.
And with us, of course, we have Disco the podcast puppy, who is hopefully all tucked out on the rug.
It's the black hound, I believe.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. The terrifying black hound covered in sand, always.
Yes.
So we are going to do a special Halloween Masters and Disasters.
Or Disasters and Masters in this case, weirdly. Yeah.
So if you're new here, what we usually do is we take apart a piece of art and see if we can put it back together just a little bit better. But sometimes what we like to do is take one great example of a story and a remake or a sequel and try and pick apart what happened. Now, this is an unusual one in that the original is fucking awful.
Yeah, today we're looking at The Blobs, which is the Blob from 1958 with Steve McQueen in his first starring role and the last time he was billed as Steven. And then we're looking at the remake from 1988.
Which no one has heard of, me included.
Yeah. I remember seeing it occasionally in VHS shops in the 90s. That's about it. Never watched it.
I feel like most people all know The Blob because it's the movie that they're watching in the drive-in in Greece.
Exactly, yeah. The Blob is, I was saying this to you, The Blob from 1958 is one of those that casts an enormous cultural shadow despite the fact that it's got about, you know, an ounce of material in it. It's terrible, right?
Yeah.
It's really, really bad, but everybody knows it. And apparently it was originally called The Molten Meteor, and then they changed the name to The Glob. And then
I think The Glob is better.
The Glob might be better, but apparently there was a comic book that had already used a character called The Glob, so they couldn't get the rights to it, so they changed to The Blob. But the name was kind of deliberate so that people would make fun of it, and it gets free advertising from like hack comedians at the time. So
which
kind
clever.
Of, yeah, like the marketing on this is spot on.
Well, then, and then we also have to mention the theme tune.
The theme tune, written by Burt Bacharach as well.
You can fucking hear it.
Yeah, you really can. If you didn't hate Burt Bacharach, it's a sort of light jazz. It leaps and creeps and glides and slides across the floor. It's a very jaunty light jazz elevator music tune for what's supposed to be a horror film.
And the movie opens like that.
Yeah.
So if you want to like establish kind of menacing tone, this is the exact opposite. It's literally easy listening. It's designed to put you at ease.
And it is an omega level earworm as well.
We're really sorry.
After 2 days of this, it's just the on hold music in my brain. It's killing me.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and creeps. Anyway, right.
Sorry.
So you're going to give us a brief synopsis of both, and then we'll try and unpack.
So a brief rundown on the original, Which people, it's a classic. It's not. It's shit.
It's awful.
We open on the back of Steve McQueen's head, and he's making out with a girl because he's supposed to be a teenager, but then we pan around to the front of Steve McQueen's head, and he's 46 years old, right?
we're talking, again, like the teenagers in Greece.
Yeah.
Kind of Stockard Channing level of teen look.
We checked, Steve McQueen was 28, playing 17.
But he looks
40. It's been a hard 28 years. I know he was in the Marines for a while, but Jesus Christ.
It's not even HD.
Anyway, he's making out with a girl in his car.
Jane,
who apparently, to give you an idea of how thinly written this character is, apparently in some of the promotional materials she was listed as Judy, but the character's name is Jane. They couldn't even nail down the name of this woman that's in
characterisation is about the same as the icon of a woman that you get on toilet doors.
Yes, yeah,
she's a skirt-shaped
object
that is in the back of shop a lot of the time and occasionally needs to be carried.
Yeah, that's a fair way to sum it up. Anyway, they're making out a make-out point because they're teenagers, allegedly.
Yeah.
She's also a little bit past her prime, I've got to say.
I mean, comfortably so, because otherwise that would be hard to watch.
Yeah. The actress was 25, but she, again, 25 in the 50s means she looks a lot more hard-written than that.
They've been through a war.
I know, there was a war. There was a nuclear apocalypse coming. There were communists everywhere. It was a tough time. Anyway, they're making out like teenagers definitely do when they see a shooting star. And Steve McQueen's like, that's
romantic.
Let's go and investigate that because I can't put up with any more of this making out because it's hell on my back. It's not actually what he says, but
Disco,
you know.
Disco Jones, stop attacking the car.
Because again, a real teenager would just keep making out in the car and ignore it. But Steve McQueen's 102, so.
Yeah, he's past his bedtime.
Exactly. He's just going to have an Ovaltine and get to bed. Then he sees a shooting star. So they go and investigate it and try and find where this shooting star has landed. But meanwhile, an old hobo who lives in the woods has found the meteor and starts poking it with a stick.
Yeah,
and
obviously.
As you do. He's like, oh man, I've got to stop poking things off in the woods. Who am I kidding? The poking's half the reason I moved out here. So he pokes the meteor and a sort of glob of jelly-like substance.
Sorry.
The other half is because I'm not allowed near school. And a sort of jelly-like substance comes out of it and attacks his hand. It sort of leaps up the stick against gravity and sucks onto his
hand.
It's
brilliantly gross and creepy.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, good idea.
Yeah.
So he staggers out into the road looking for help, and Steve and Jane run across him and say, oh, we better get this guy to a hospital. In the process of taking him to a hospital, they overtake some other fellow teenagers who are also, you know, comfortably into their 20s. The doctor says, well, we don't know what this thing is on his hand, but maybe if you go out to the woods and try and find some evidence of what caused this, because, you know, it's not a job for the police, this is a job for two teenagers that are, you know, who are in their 40s.
Yeah.
So as they leave, the other teenagers arrive and say, hey, you overtook our car. We're going to have to drag race to settle this.
Oh my gosh.
And then we have a long drag racing scene, which is fuck all to do with any part of the plot.
Also, imagine somehow they've made a drag race so boring.
Boring and drawn out. And
It is they might as well be having a parallel parking competition. Yeah. It is the least interesting, least thrilling.
I could win that one. I'm Super Queen.
They spend 20 minutes either side of it talking about it.
Yeah.
And 3 seconds driving backwards slowly.
Yeah.
It's awful.
But they're seen by the police, who then...
have another 20-minute conversation.
Yeah, Dave, the local cop, accosts Steve McQueen. And then we have a sort of unfunny 10-minute improv scene of Steve McQueen trying to talk his way out of trouble like he's Will Smith in The Fresh Prince doing the can under the arm bit. But not funny and, again, just drawn out long scenes.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, eventually they get out of that one. And all the teenagers go to the woods to look for... Let me see if I can find the actual line that I wrote down here. Well, one of my notes here just said McQueen is wearing a fucking wedding ring this entire film.
He's got a huge wedding ring on.
And I checked, he was married at the time. That is his wedding ring because he's 28 years old and he's married.
Jane doesn't mind. No. She doesn't have opinions or thoughts.
I'm a woman, hello.
Come on, Scott Shape. We've got to investigate a mystery.
I've got a note here. Meanwhile, back at the Alien, the doctor is concerned that the blob is getting bigger. He calls around to get his nurse to come back in because he might have to amputate the old hobo's arm. They go to the woods and they're looking around and they don't realise there's a hobo with a cabin, but then the hobo has a dog that starts barking. And Jane says, like, oh, maybe there is a house around here. And one of the men says, that doesn't sound like a house, it sounds like a dog. You idiot woman.
But then they're like, oh, there's a house with a dog.
Yeah.
But then they go, maybe that's what she was thinking about. Yeah. Like, no, stupid woman. Yeah. Houses don't sound like that.
Houses don't bark, you dumb broad.
So if you want to know what sexism feels like, just watch that. Just watch that exchange. That is how men still talk to women sometimes.
What? Sorry, I wasn't listening. Anyway, Nurse Kate comes back to the doctor's office at... I'm kidding. Nurse Kate comes back to the doctor's office at his request as he plans to amputate the hobo's arm, but they find him missing and the blob now man-sized. It's dissolved the old hobo entirely. It eats Kate, and Steve and Jane arrive back in time for Steve to see it eating the doctor. Steve says they should go to the police as they'll know what to do because they have protocols for this, presumably.
Yep. It was the 50s.
Yeah. The police don't believe him, but Sergeant Dave agrees to have a look. Then we get a chess-playing scene. One of the police is into chess, and then all the other cops go to see if the doctor's dead, and then we get a scene of the guy...
We're going to talk about this.
The guy playing chess over the radio with another... Like, we already had a...
There's a flesh-eating alien on the loose movie.
We've had a drag racing scene, now we're having a chess scene. In a minute we're going to do fucking water polo, and then probably a long golf digression for reasons. It's an 80-minute film. This is not a long film. Somehow we're eating...
How is the flesh-eating alien not the most interesting or pivotal part of this story?
We've discovered alien life. It's the most important discovery in human history, and we're pausing for drag racing and chess.
Yeah.
Jane's lost the dog by this point, by the way. She's just wandering. She picked the dog up to rescue it.
Oh, stupid bitch.
Like, she rescues the dog from the cabin, and in the next scene, she's dogless. And, and at one point mentions, I wonder what happened to that dog. Like, you picked it up, and they just let it loose somewhere
Jane's
else.
Care of this dog is as intermittently written as the whole of the rest of her character.
Yeah, sporadic at best.
I'm surprised that sometimes she doesn't go, put female dialogue here.
Yeah. Yeah. Something a woman would say. The police investigate the doctor's office, which has things knocked over and signs of a struggle. They touch everything in the crime scene and let some teenagers in with them.
Move because, it around.
Yeah. Steve, what do you make of this? Oh, I don't know, I better poke it.
40 minutes later, they'll go, oh no, don't leave any fingerprints.
Yeah.
After you've just moved everything.
But Mrs. Porter arrives, and if you don't know who that is, neither do anybody else
no
in the
idea.
Audience.
Still,
just
still don't know.
An old woman turns up in her pyjamas, say, oh no, the doctor is out of town on business. Jane literally spends this entire scene stood in the background staring.
She doesn't even
distance.
Move.
She doesn't know, any lines. She's just staring politely. The blob kills a mechanic at the all-night garage. And I say the all-night garage because Mrs. Porter mentions that, like, the doctor called one of his friends about 11, and it's obviously past 11. It's dark out, right? So this is about midnight.
I told you you have to let this go.
But there are two mechanics in the garage working on a car. What? Like, it's an all-night garage. This isn't a thing.
All the way through this movie, they kept turning to me and going, what time is it?
What? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't, but it's not going to by you getting cross.
Okay, so they go back to the police station so they can't decide what's happened, and Steve and Jane's parents turn out to be cross at them and middle-aged. Nobody believes Steve about the blob.
Yep, recurring plot beat. Nobody believes Steve. Over and over and over again. Yeah.
They go home, but then Jane sneaks out. I've got a note here. To find the dog, to investigate further, it's not made clear. But she's caught by her brother, who's one of those child actors in the 50s who cannot act a fucking lick. And then she's trying to sneak out, and he's just talking loudly by yelling his lines at her. And she says, oh, if you're quiet, I'll bring you a dog. I like dogs! What's its name? Oh, you can call it anything you like if you're just quiet. I'm going to name it William! Oh, well, that's a fine name for a dog. I'm trying to sneak out. Okay, happy sneaking! I like dogs! I'm a child! That's a pretty accurate rendition of that scene, I feel.
And again, it's good that the filmmakers are getting us to spend time here with a child we've never met, yes, discussing hypothetical names for a dog they may or may not find when there's a fucking flesh-eating alien on the loose.
I miss the chess scene, frankly. Also, you know, the ages look wrong for this. I said there's a lot of people in the 50s where, like, you know, they went away for a few months and then they came back and then their parents had a little brother for them late in life. And,
yeah,
I'm getting that vibe.
That is not Jane's brother.
Yeah. Steve sneaks out too, and then they have a long scene recapping the plot to each other thus far. Which is, nobody believes me about this alien, but I'm sure I saw an alien eating the doctor.
This is one of those films where it is so badly written that even when you are literally sitting here trying to make notes, it is impossible to keep your attention on it.
Yeah.
It is so boring.
Yeah. Steve and Jane recruit the other teenagers to come around the town investigating so that people will take them seriously. They'll find some evidence. There's almost a plot beat here for a minute. They skim off.
Oh, occasionally
one.
Yeah. They'll stumble into doing the plot.
Because one of the police mentions seeing an empty house on Main Street at the police. He's like, oh, it's deserted. The TV was playing, but there's nobody in it. So, like, we're implying that the blob is picking people off in the town, which is an interesting idea, but we're doing nothing with it aside from this. The teenagers go out door knocking to warn people, but the adults are all drunk and the other teens are all busy making out.
Yeah.
Steve and Jane find the dog by a supermarket.
I'm going to call him William!
You call him? I like dogs! I say, oh, Steve, it's the little dog. I wonder what happened to that if I let it go, because I'm a woman. They find it by the supermarket, but the supermarket, again, is unlocked and empty like the Marie Celeste. Like, maybe, you know, whoever runs the supermarket's been blobbed. But they encounter the blob inside the supermarket, and they hide in the freezer where the blob won't follow. It tries to slide in the door, but doesn't like the cold, so it retreats.
Plot,
I know. Steve and Co. then try to call the police again, but Sergeant Tightass answers and is still convinced it's a prank, and that the kids are just jealous of his war record.
This is my favourite bit.
There's nothing like, that's the trouble with these teenagers, they're jealous of my war record. What? That means less than nothing to anyone. Why? What? That's why they're making up aliens, because I killed all those Japs. What? What are you talking about? You PTSD-riddled lunatic. What the fuck?
Yeah, teenagers are famously obsessed with the CVs of adults they never think about.
Yes. Yeah. There's a bloke lives here from the Falklands, and I fucking hate it. And I'm not a teenager. I still look younger than Steve McQueen. Anyway.
Teenager, I didn't know if most of my friends' parents even had faces. That is how little attention I paid to any adult around me.
Well, anyway.
Oh God.
The teenagers start making a noise to wake the town. They start setting off the air raid alarm, which I don't know how they've managed to do that, but all the town gathers like, hey, what's going on? What's the meaning of this? Hey, what do you know about that? It's the 50s. Hello. They all gather in the town square and Steve McQueen says, look, you have to believe me, everybody. There's a blob and nobody's seen it and nobody believes him. Meanwhile, because the movie theatre is presumably showing all night movies. Again, it's got to be 1 in the morning by this point.
Stop trying to put a timeline on it.
The The movie theater is the most...
It's the late night spook show.
It's a late night spook show, see? It's a doubleheader. It must be the most well-insulated cinema in the universe because nobody heard the commotion outside, so all
the air raid siren. Yeah. Why is everyone in this town not dead?
I don't know.
No one can hear the siren.
They're also... Everybody's still at the cinema and the blob attacks the cinema. This is the scene that's in Greece, if you...
It's probably the best bit.
Yeah, because the blob's in it.
Because the blob's in it.
Yeah. And everybody runs screaming out of the cinema. And about 4,000 people run screaming out of the cinema. Yeah. The number of extras in this fucking scene is relentless. Also, hilariously, I checked in the IMDb trivia, and apparently early on when they're at the cinema, there's a shoe store in the background, and the lights are off. And the guy that owned the shoe store was working late that night and saw that they were shooting a film. So when everybody comes running out, he turns the lights on in his shoe store so you can see that he's got a sale on, which is just fantastic work from that guy. Anyway. Everyone runs out of this theatre and the blob emerges, now having eaten tens of people, so it's getting huge now. Jane's brother turns up and tries to kill the blob with his cap gun because children are idiots. He runs into
wants to call it William.
He's going
to
call it William. Bang, bang. This isn't a real gun. I'm useless. He runs into a diner, Steve and Jane running after him, and the blob sort of engulfs the diner.
They're going to burn to death in a minute.
Yeah, because the police try shooting a power line down onto the blob, but it does nothing except set the diner on fire. And then one of the local fire brigade is out and goes, "Well, the diner's on fire." Like, yeah, thank you. I can see how you got this job. Fucking moron.
Well, he can identify fire.
Yeah,
he's quite indifferent towards it.
Yeah, just pointing it out. It's his main job. They couldn't afford a Dalmatian, so they got this guy to go, "Yep, that's a fire." Whilst trying to put the fire out with a CO2 extinguisher, Steve realises the blob doesn't like the cold from the extinguisher. So he yells this to the people outside.
Plot! We've got some plot!
There's some plot! He's been crawling desperately across the desert of this movie looking for a plot. Ages ago. He yells to the people outside to go and get CO2 extinguishers, which they do. All the teenagers rush down to the high school and take all their extinguishers. The townsfolk then freeze the blob with all their extinguishers. And they call the government, who knows what to do, because it's the 50s, and the police, the army rather, send in a cargo plane and load the frozen blob onto it and then dump it in the Arctic so they can never unthaw again. Which I've got a note here, great 50s thinking. It's a temporary solution and that'll do. And
my God, this means with climate change, the blob's going to defrost.
Literally the last line of the movie is, well, as long as the Arctic stays cold, which is it's unintentionally foreshadowing the ecological collapse of the fucking...
Oh my God, that's how we die.
Yeah, it's blob.
That's
I've got a note here, actually. Nice to have a film where the answer is science, which was a theme in the 50s. We used to trust science, right?
That's
rather
true.
Than, like, these days, we know there's no such thing as blobs, even as I'm being dissolved by it. It's a leftist woke conspiracy. Just jam.
Brilliant. Well done, Luke Kane.
Thank you.
That synopsis is 20 times more entertaining than the actual movie itself.
Yeah.
So well done. So do you want to... So the remake does follow a huge amount of these plot
it's
beats
pretty
quite closely,
close.
But
yeah.
it makes it a lot better.
Do you want to go through the remake, and we can talk as we go about why this works better than what they were doing in the previous.
We can attempt that.
Let's try that.
It's going to be a mess.
So in Blob 88, which is available for free on YouTube. We couldn't buy it anywhere. I tried. But it is entirely on YouTube. The version on YouTube cuts off the opening credits and the last line of the movie, but you've got 99% of the film. You're not missing a lot.
Yeah.
Apparently, from what I'm told, the opening credits take place like going through a small town. And it's a ghost town. It's deserted. There's nobody there. And you're meant to think something terrible has happened. It turns out the whole town is at the football game. Which is a fairly good opening gag, but we don't see it on YouTube because it's been truncated. Anyway, high school football player Paul asks out cheerleader Meg, who's played by Shawnee Smith, who you'll know from the Saw franchise and a couple of other things.
She's one of those actors that you just recognise.
Yeah, she's Thingy from that thing. You know.
Yeah.
She was in Becker as well. Because
she's not in the thing, though. She's in the blob.
Yes. Well, she's not in the blob. It's caught her. She's just in the movie, the blob. Anyway. Football player Meg asks out. Football player Paul asks out cheerleader Meg, whilst rebel bad boy Brian, Kevin Dillon, attempts a motorcycle jump on the edge of town for shits and giggles, only to crash and be laughed at by a woodland hobo. Meanwhile, the local sheriff is hitting on the diner waitress and warns the returning Brian that he'll be watching him now that he's 18 and he'll have to be tried as an adult for any more crimes that he commits because he's a bad boy.
Yeah. So should I talk about why this is already better than the other one? Okay, great. So in the first Blob, a really big problem is that the dialogue and the storytelling, just the craft skills of how the story is told, are really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And I think this is possibly because we've moved on a bit. Like, we are used to slightly faster paced things now.
Yeah.
But also, there's tons of stuff that you can go back to from this era, from even earlier. There's films from the 40s that don't have this problem. Yeah. So this isn't just era specific. But basically, like we said, we have these long scenes that are largely talking. They are often dialogue that is about something that's happened off screen or somebody off screen. It's almost like a play in that way, in that, like, we're just gonna, like, spend ages
waiting for Blobbo
talking. They spend quite a long time talking about this police officer called Birdie, who I don't think we meet him incredibly briefly. He's talked about a lot, though, as like the mean police officer. And that is not what screenwriting is for. Screenwriting is for telling stories through images. So the scenes are really interminable. And this is another thing that when you're learning script writing, you're told, which is arrive late, leave early.
Yeah.
So you should arrive sort of almost trying to catch up in the scene. Like, oh, okay, where are we? What's going on? So the audience is sort of leaning in, trying to work out what's happening. And then you have to leave before we get a conclusion. So you're like, oh, what is going to happen? Okay, oh, okay, where are we now? What's happening now? So it keeps you active as an audience. Whereas this, I mean,
the Blob turns up a day ahead of time, sits around awkwardly having a cup of tea. And then
the chess police.
Welcome.
But in terms of, like, the craft of how you do a scene, the scene with the chess police is exactly. So we arrive, so Steve McQueen, like, oh, we've got this terrible problem, let's go to the police station. We cut to the police station, the police are having a 10-minute chat about chess. So we've arrived really early before Steve McQueen arrives in this scene.
Oh, it turns out McGinty over here likes chess.
A long old setup about chess.
Yeah.
And then Steve McQueen arrives. We get the actual bulk of what the scene is about, which is Steve McQueen trying to convince the police to go. They go with him to go and investigate the alien, and we stay in the police station with a guy playing chess.
Yeah.
We've done the exact opposite of what you're supposed to do. We arrived really early and we stay really late.
And again, it bears repeating. It's an hour and 20, that film. It's not like you're not trying to drag it out for 3 hours. You've got a short runtime and you're taking it up with this.
Exactly. And and all of the scenes are like this. What that does is it makes the pace of this movie fucking glacial. Yeah. It is unbearably slow.
It's like a sort of gelatinous crawl across the floor of some kind. Where it's,
and that is like an attrition on how much you fucking care, because the characters are already quite thinly drawn. The appeal of this movie is not the deep inner workings of Officer Chess and how Steve feels about authority. It's an action movie in which there was barely any action.
Yeah. Whereas in the 88 version, all this stuff is setting things up for later.
It is bombing along, and it is quick and pacey, and it is introducing characters in action. It's exactly what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. Brian goes to the garage where he works part-time to borrow some tools to fix the bike that he crashed trying to do this stunt. Again, this will become relevant, which is important. Yep. You know? That night, a meteor crashes near a hobo shack. He goes out to poke the meteor with a stick.
Yeah, fine.
He's like, oh, I gotta stop poking things in the woods. Who am I kidding? My family's been poking things in these woods for 30 years. I'm not gonna stop. Oh, God, this is how my father died. So
I think there was a baby in the shack that the dog was protecting in the original movie.
Yes, that's
it. He's grown up now.
Yeah. My father was a wood hobo. I'm a wood hobo.
The only thing he loved was poking things with sticks.
Yeah. Well, he was a young child. He already learned stick poking from the
that's all he knew.
Yeah, that's why I say it out here, poking things.
It's a terrible
sticks.
Family curse.
Old man sticky poke. Anyway, he gets the Blob on his hand, so same plot beat.
Although the crater that the Blob has landed in is vast.
Yeah, like a meteor impact almost.
Yes, it is.
Whereas in the original film, it's a sort of shallow sky satellite dish from the 90s sized thing with a rock perfectly positioned in the middle of it.
It's like a bowling ball in the original.
Meg's younger brother, brackets, who can act, a child actor who's actually good in this, is planning to see a movie. In the town that night.
So we've swapped Jane for Meg, and Meg actually has thoughts and a character and she does things.
Brian is in the woods trying to fix his bike and runs across the hobo, who's trying to hack his own arm off with a hatchet to remove the Blob, and he hacks his wrist, but then the Blob just sort of gloops over the wound and keeps eating his arm.
Storytelling through action.
Good beat. The hobo then runs off into the road and is nearly hit by Paul and Meg, who are on their date.
Yep.
So now Brian and Paul and Meg have to take the hobo to the hospital.
It's almost like everything links up and makes sense.
Yeah, right. They get to the doctor's office, and Brian says that, like, they're more concerned about insurance details than they are about helping anybody, so he fucks off. Thank God that period of American history is over. Whilst waiting for the doctor to come and have a look at the hobo, Paul notices the hobo's blanket is bulging ominously. He summons the doctor, pulls back the sheet, finds that the hobo's been melted to death. He's like melted from the ribs down. It's pretty good. Pretty good.
It's really good.
Yeah. Paul goes to an office to call police, but is then eaten by the blob. We get a left turn psycho thing where you think he's going to be the Stephen McQueen character, but then he gets blobbed to death really suddenly. Blobbed. Yeah.
It's brilliant. Yeah. It's brilliant. Really lovely twist.
Meg sees this, but the sheriff doesn't believe her. Now, trying to rescue him as he's being melted, his arm melts off, which Meg pulls off, and there's a half-melted hobo, but the police are like, nah, Brian, the bad boy with the motorbike, he probably did this somehow. Book him, boys. One count of melting a hobo and one count of severing an arm.
They have done a really good job in this movie of, like, clearing up a lot of the plot, all the unnecessary stuff, and making it much, much more pacey and exciting. However, the fact that there's two melted men there's a really credible eyewitness saying that a monster did this, and they are like, no, we're not going to look at that.
Probably
or investigate.
Teenagers.
That is a plot hole in this movie.
Still, it's not perfect. The blob eats Paul's mate and his girl, who are parked out at Roofie Point. There's a 80s sex assault bit, but then the guy gets melted. So
There's this horrible scene. Again, it's a really good characterful scene of, like, just demonstrates what an asshole this guy is. He's got a trunk built of his car, which is like a horrible, like, seduction.
It's very Quagmire from Family Guy.
It's like he's got like a little kind of like mini bar cocktail.
He's given this girl a ring to show how serious he is. But then when you look in his trunk, he's got a little thing full of rings.
Box full of rings. Yeah, and he's like, you hate him so much, and then he gets eaten by the blob, and it's fucking great.
That is good. The police interrogate Brian on suspicion of melting a hobo, but release him due to a stultifying lack of evidence, which is that they picked him up across town whilst that hobo was melting at the hospital. So, yeah, looks like he didn't do it, Chief.
I don't know what they think that they're doing.
Meg sneaks out of her parents' house to bail Brian out, but sees that he's already being released, so she follows him to the diner, as he's the only person that might believe her, because he saw the thing on the old man's hand too. The blob gets into the diner through the plumbing and melts the pot wash guy, which is a pretty good moment as well.
That's really great.
Fran from the diner runs outside to the phone booth to call the sheriff, but the blob's already eaten him too, and then her. So
this is a really key thing about why this movie works. Yeah. Luke, in this film, they fight the blob.
Yeah, the blob keeps eating people and it's dramatic. Yeah.
This movie, that is the blob. Yeah. They actually spend time.
There's quite a lot of blob going on in this film.
Almost 100% of the plot is about them trying to defeat the blob.
Yeah, that's where they've gone right with this,
It's such a simple thing.
Hey, that's a better idea.
If all my script notes could be this simple.
The creepy local priest sees the blob disappearing into a sewer and goes to investigate the ruined diner. Have I missed the... Oh, yeah. That's...
No, she's in the phone box, and then the police officer that she calls is melted.
Brian and Meg flee into the diner, into the walk-in freezer, where the blob won't follow them.
Yes, we get that. So repeat.
Yeah. And the creepy local priest sees the blob disappearing into a sewer and goes to investigate the now ruined diner, finding frozen blob fragments on the freezer floor, which he puts into a jar.
Yep.
Brian and Meg go to the police station, but nobody knows where the sheriff is, because he's been melted.
Been dissolved.
Yeah. The deputy is out in the woods trying to find out what happened to the hobo. Brian and Meg go to find the deputy and are captured by an army team in hazmat gear.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Okay, so what is another thing that makes this movie much, much more interesting and compelling to watch is about the forces of antagonism.
Yes.
So they are not just in the movie, in the original, it feels like the antagonist is really the police. The police's weird ambivalence about Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Because he keeps going to them and they keep...
I just don't trust that guy. He's 47 and he's hanging out with teenagers.
But they also don't outright not believe him. One of the police kind of believes him. So what you end up is this weird, endless conversation where he's trying to convince a policeman who could just look... and it's really boring. But here, the blob is like a proper powerful antagonist. Yeah. It is growing. It can go through pipes. It can like climb. Yeah. It's really fast as well.
Yeah.
Unlike the original blob, which is really quite slow.
Yeah.
And in the first scene when it eats the nurse, I'm like, just walk in the other room.
Oh no. Oh, it's coming to get me. Oh, I'm going to be eaten.
It's like the sort of equivalent of a gelatinous Roomba.
Yeah.
It's not.
Beware of the Roomba. It's sweet creeps.
I'm pretty sure if with a very slight upped walking pace, yeah, you could outpace this. But this blob in this movie is really, really, it's a good threat.
It can do more leaping motions and it's got tentacles.
It's got tentacles. It can grab you. Yeah. It can come up through the pipes. It's much, much better. And in addition to that, they then add this entire new subplot, which is about the government coming in, trying to contain it, which is another huge obstacle that we're now going to be facing. Yeah. It's a really beautiful complication.
And also something interesting about the difference between the 50s and the 80s, that in the 50s you call the government and they send the army and they fix everything for you, whereas in the 80s people don't trust the government anymore. Yep. Right? This, oh, actually turns out the government might be crooked.
More
on that later. It's very sort of post-Watergate, I guess. I guess that's the turning point in that. Dr. Meadows, the head army investigator, tells the deputy to go back to town and explain that they're investigating the meteor that landed nearby. Brian says that it's more than a germ that they're dealing with, says, you know, it's become a blob. The blob attacks the cinema projectionist where Meg's little brother and his friend are watching a slasher film. They're doing a film within a film beat, which is quite well done in this as
Again,
well.
So it's another repeat, but it's really smart. We set it up earlier. Yeah. It makes sense.
Dr. Meadows puts Meg and Brian in the van, and it's made clear that this is not negotiable. They're prisoners. Brian jimmies the lock on the transport van and tells Meg that they should escape, but she won't abandon her family who were in town being rounded up with the rest of the townsfolk. Brian jumps out and leaves her. So there's a stolen knife from Empire Strikes Back here, where she says, "I'll take care of yourself, Brian. It's the only thing you're good at," which is...
But that means that Brian's going to have a character arc, because he's going to learn to not be selfish and become a hero.
Well, he sort of looks after the van as it's taking Meg away and then sort of chastises himself for giving a shit about a cheerleader, which is...
Yeah, nice. It's nice.
Yeah. Meg is quarantined for the rest of the time, but sneaks away when she realises that her brother and his friend are still at the unevacuated movie theatre. And again, they haven't sounded a big klaxon or anything, so they're just going house to house, which is why the theatre hasn't been evacuated yet. Makes more sense.
It does make sense, yeah, because the government are trying to contain it.
Having killed the projectionist, the blob attacks the main house, and in the chaos, Meg and her brother and his friend escape into an alley and then into the sewers. Brian, meanwhile, is still in the woods and retrieves his bike and sneaks back to the meteor site, where he hears Dr. Meadows talking about how the meteor was a satellite which contained an experimental weapon. If necessary, they'll sacrifice the town to keep the weapon. So you can't trust the government. The army are up to something. It's an experiment that's gone
wrong.
There
you go.
Yeah.
It's getting more and more peril.
Yeah, we're adding, ramping up the stakes.
Ramping up the stakes over and over and over again, which is what you want in a movie.
Yeah. Brian is spotted and flees on his motorbike, and the only way out is via the sweet jump that he's been trying to perfect. He can't quite get it.
I must say, this is fucking stupid.
Yeah, it is.
Because we previously see when he's attempting the jump, he doesn't make it. And what happens, Luke?
He skids his bike and is basically fine.
He slightly falls over and doesn't even graze his knee.
Yeah.
So this becoming a pivotal, oh my God, is he going to make this jump?
Yeah.
It's like, well, I saw what happened when he didn't. He was fine.
Yeah.
He didn't even twist his ankle.
But he does make the jump.
Yeah!
And he escapes. Brian, it's a really complicated stunt, because we've got a motorbike jump, helicopter going overhead, and a truck crashing in the same time. It's actually very complicated to orchestrate, but also I take your point, that there was less peril than we were being led to believe.
They just need to make it have, underneath the bridge, there needs to be a hole, you know, like where you could fall.
Brian rides his bike off into a storm drain, having overheard that the blob has chased Meg and the kids down into the sewers. Soldiers also enter the sewers when Meg and the kids are fleeing the blob. It corners them and eats the other kid. I didn't get that kid's name. But fair play to this film for killing a child, because you go, oh, there's kids in this scene, they'll be fine. No, one of them gets blobbed and dissolved.
Yeah.
We never see that in
And they set him up as obnoxious, so you're like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Meg and her brother escape. The brother through a drain, like a reverse it. So she gets thrown back out onto the street through a storm drain. None of us float down here. But Meg's too big for that, so she escapes deeper into the sewers with the help of returning Brian. Brian and Meg encounter one of the surviving soldiers, most of whom have been eaten, and the three of them make it to a manhole in time to see Dr. Meadows order that the manhole be sealed in order to contain the blob. Brian takes the soldier's rocket launcher and uses it to blow open the manhole cover. Look, he's got a note here. Who brings a rocket launcher to a sewer fight? That's the worst weapon you can be using in a confined space.
Splinter from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? No.
Anyway.
Just thinking of sewer fights. That's my only reference.
Sewer fights in a sewer. Yeah, very few people. It's gross.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. Dolph Lundgren's version of The Punisher, nerds. Brian and Meg escape the sewer but are held at gunpoint by the army and the sheriff's deputy. Brian begins to explain...
See, now they're not fighting the blob. They're fighting the army.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Brian begins to explain that the blob is a bioweapon and Dr. Meadows orders him shot, but the blob reaches out a tentacle and drags Meadows into the sewer to be devoured.
Yay!
Conveniently, it has to be said, but okay.
Blob.
Team blob. The rest of the soldiers bomb the sewer, but that just angers the blob and causes it to attack the town, which the creepy priest sees as divine punishment. In the chaos, a soldier with a flamethrower attacks the blob to no avail, but he gets set on fire, and in trying to put him... He gets caught, set on fire, his tanks go off, set several people on fire, including the creepy priest. Meg tries to put out the priest with a CO2 extinguisher and realises that the blob doesn't like the cold.
Yeah, so it's the same beat. It's so smart.
Yeah. She tells Brian, who runs back to the garage, remembering that at the garage where he was at the start of the movie, there's a snowmaker truck that was being fixed there. I don't know what that is.
I don't know what it is.
I believe it's a thing. Yeah. It's a truck that like sprays cold stuff. I don't know. But I'm presuming
we don't know, but we know that it is the thing we need.
Yeah, I'm on board. Yeah. So Brian steals that and attacks the blob with the snowmaker. But the blob flips it, causing its liquid nitrogen tanks to fall off. Meg takes a gun and a bomb from a downed soldier, shooting the blob to get its attention, and then lure it onto the tanks, which she detonates, freezing the creature solid and shattering it.
How far we have come from Jane standing in the back of shop doing
staring
nothing.
Staring into the distance. Yeah.
Meg's got like a...
Yeah. She's got an M16 and a bomb and a plan. Damn it. Yeah. Sometime later, far away, the creepy priest is horribly scarred but still alive, giving a doomsday sermon in a tent. Afterwards, a parishioner asks if he really believes that the day of reckoning is coming. He replies that it will be soon and glances at a jar of blob fragments that are now thawed out and alive that he's got on his desk.
It's good. They're clearly aiming for a sequel that they never got.
They never got it, yeah.
But it was good. Yeah. Very good. Thank you, Nick Haynes. So I think, like, overall, the thing is about... I've probably said this before, but I will say it again. When you're constructing a story, this is a Sarah Waters quote, the novelist. She said you've got to think about it like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
And if you think about the ride of this movie, it is such a better ride.
Yeah.
There's a ton more action. The stakes. So if it's a roller coaster, we're like, we go up really, really, really high rather than just sort of pootling around on the teacup, the cup and saucers as we do in the original one.
I'm going on the waltzers. I like dogs.
In fact, you don't go either the waltzers, just stand near it and talk about being on the waltzers. So,
oh, Steve, I'd love to go on the waltzers.
Shut up, June. So tons more stuff happens. The stuff, there's a lot more events. There's loads of people, a lot more people get blobbed.
Yeah.
The blob gets bigger and bigger and scarier and scarier. The government get involved.
But also, like I said, everything is setting up something else. So like early on, we see the sheriff hitting on the diner waitress. And then she says, oh, I'll get off at 11. So he arrives at 11 and gets blobbed. And we don't realise that until she's trapped in the phone booth trying to call him. And then we see the dissolving sheriff in the middle of the blob. Yeah.
So this links to another thing that I've just been like learning about. Because I'm at TV school at the moment.
Yeah.
And they were talking about, it actually comes from South Park, from Trey Parker and Matt Stone. Yeah. Have this thing that every single story, you have to be able to say after, you say a line of plot.
Yeah.
And then you either have to say therefore or but.
Yeah.
So every bit of plot links up either because Meg learns that her brother is trapped in the cinema, therefore Meg goes to the cinema to save him. Or you could say Meg learns that her brother's trapped in the cinema, but she is trapped in the police car, therefore she breaks out of the police car. And it just keeps everything completely causal and linked all the way through it. And this movie does that. Everything is set up, like you say. The priest is set up, like everything. There's even a little bit where they're trying to buy condoms at the beginning. And they like buy it from this pharmacist. They're like two teenage boys buying condoms. And the pharmacist is a bit disapproving. Yeah. And then he goes to pick up Meg for the date. And his dad's the pharmacist.
Yeah, we're doing jokes in here. Actual jokes.
So everything's just really well constructed. So, you know, just in the words of Elvis, we have a little less conversation
and a lot more action. a lot more blobbing. I don't know if we have anything else to say really, other than the original, like I say, cast is weirdly huge cultural shadow, but it's shit. And actually the remake that nobody saw is a much, much better movie.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? And I was thinking about, do we need another? Could we have a 2022 blob? I mean, the answer is obviously yes.
Yeah.
But one of the main problems we seem to have in the blob in both of the versions, actually, is that, and it's quite smart. So you set up your protagonist as a teenager and a teenager who the police don't trust, right? So that means that they don't have very much power. And then when they're trying to get help, they're not believed. Whereas now everyone's got a camera phone.
Yeah.
So you would just show them the video that
and
you have
on the
blob.
And also the teenagers are just at home on the TikTok all the time rather than investigating things. I'm an old man like Steve McQueen.
Maybe you could do something with like, oh, the blob is like on TikTok and everyone thinks it's a stunt.
I'm doing the blob challenge where I poke this alien.
Yeah, and everyone's like, oh my god, this is amazing. It's supposed to be like viral marketing for like a movie or something, and it is actually an alien.
That's interesting.
That would be quite smart.
There was incidentally a sequel to the original blob, which I'm not going to bother with. It was called like Return of the Blob or Beware of the Blob, wasn't it? It was like a campier, stupider sequel. Directed by Larry Hagman, who played JR on Dallas. So if anyone's writing a pub quiz at the moment, there's a good question that you who directed the sequel to the Blob. it was JR.
But there's just one thing we got to talk about, Lee. Kevin Dillon.
Kevin Dillon as Brian in the remake, yeah.
What was his storied career after this? And also Matt Dillon, question mark. Why the Dillons?
I know you don't believe in the Dillons.
I don't!
You can't see Matt Dillon.
My brain refuses to acknowledge Matt Dillon.
Yeah, and then I said to you, well, I'm pretty sure he was good in There's Something About Mary. And I was like, was he in There's Something About Mary? And I realised, you're right, Matt Dillon doesn't exist.
It's a cultural void.
Yeah, and Kevin Dillon is the less attractive brother who was in the remake of The Blob.
Is it Matt Dillon that was in and Out?
No. Was it? I don't know. I don't... Yes.
And their listeners.
Yes, it was. He was the actor who outs... Yes, okay, that's
the real Halloween mystery. Does Matt Dillon exist?
I'm telling you, I've seen Matt Dillon. He ate a hobo in the woods.
I'm going to call him William.
Happy Halloween, everybody.
So we've just got some housekeeping to
do. Yeah, housekeeping in general, maintenance.
Our Halloween housekeeping is, you might have heard in earlier episodes that we were going to do a book club, Halloween book club of The Shining. Now, because I've been just absolutely overrun with work.
You've not been home for several weeks. You've been in London and...
Yeah, and...
Swamped.
Completely swamped. And it's a really thick book. It's a great book, but I have not finished it. I'm certainly not going to finish it by next week. But we are still going to do a Shining book club. We're just going to do it in December.
Yeah, I'm going to do it at some point.
So keep reading The Shining, and I hope you enjoy it or not.
Yeah.
In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do that in a variety of ways.
You can email us artsholepod@gmail.com.
Oh no.
I think it's
Artshole Podcast. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, have a look. There'll be a link. We're at Artshole Pod, I can tell you that much, on the Twitter.
And we have patreon.com/thearshole, where you can get exclusive bonus content. We will be updating our Patreon episodes very, very soon. Yeah. A big, lovely shout out to our wonderful patrons.
Yeah, again, you've been incredibly busy, and as a one-man show, this will get deeply weird very soon.
For you and Disco, and frankly, her dramaturgical notes are wanting.
She's not really pulling her weight on this show. We should also acknowledge, last year for October, we did a Black History Month episode as well, because it's Black History Month. Again, you haven't had time to watch extra stuff right now, so we've not watched a lot of black cinema. So we're going to try and do that at some point as well, but it might not be within the month.
We're going to have a delayed Black History Month episode, but we are going to be on it. Yeah, absolutely. Because you might have noticed we pre-recorded a ton of stuff because I just haven't been here.
You haven't been here.
I've been locked in a room in London for weeks and weeks and weeks.
But other than that, I think that's a wrap on that one.
I think that's it.
And just beware of the blob.
It creeps. It creeps.